This episode of The Sweaty Penguin is brought to you by Nihilism. Are you looking to reignite your emo phase under the thin guise of philosophy? Try Nihilism today! Or don't. It doesn't matter. Nothing does.
Well, it appears I put my foot in my mouth in spectacular fashion during our permitting episode, and unfortunately, the doctors say that my leg is stuck like that for now, so while I wait for that glow stick to crack, let's get into it. In that episode a month ago, I talked all about how Congress tried to ram through the controversial Mountain Valley Pipeline Project in West Virginia and force approvals of all its environmental permits, and the Fourth Circuit Court stepped in and stopped that. But on July 27th, less than a week after the episode aired, the Supreme Court ruled that the Fourth Circuit did not have the power to stop the project and the pipeline could proceed. And after a lot more research, it appears that the Supreme Court may have been right in that decision purely from a legal perspective, but the reason why is one of the most bizarre and honestly frightening things I've ever heard, even scarier than when Sherry Papini's family thought she was actually kidnapped. Good Wednesday morning, and welcome back to Wednesday episodes, by the way. It's been a lot of hard work over the last year to get back to our 2-episode-per-week schedule, but I'm so excited to get back to it, double the episodes, and double the optimism that was called refreshing by Forbes magazine, and childish and naive by every American over the age of 27. I'm Ethan Brown, and this is Tip of the Iceberg, where I will break down some environmental news and then answer a question from our listeners on the air now every week, so get in there, submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. I can take twice the questions now, so do not miss out. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so sign up at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. The Sweaty Penguin is presented by Peril and Promise, a public media initiative from the WNET Group in New York, reporting on the issues and solutions around climate change. You can learn more at pbs.org/perilandpromise. The Mountain Valley Pipeline is a 303-mile under-construction natural gas pipeline from northwestern West Virginia to southern Virginia, with a possible 75-mile extension to North Carolina, about the same length of the line for any women's public restroom. The pipeline would transport natural gas from the Marcellus Shale, which we have an episode on, and the Utica Shale, which is another carbon bomb, down toward the coast, where it can be used by U.S. consumers and likely exported abroad. Many are criticizing the Mountain Valley Pipeline, and there's a number of reasons why. One, it's ugly. Just kidding, I'm sure it has a great personality. For real, one, many argue that there isn't a real need for the gas it will transport. Even though the pipeline owners say they have customers for all the gas, only 35.5% is actually promised to specific companies. The rest might become a financial risk, especially as large energy companies aren't showing a demand for this gas unless someone wants to throw a gas-themed corporate blowout. Two, the pipeline has run way over budget, from an initial estimate of $3.5 billion to over $6.6 billion now. MVP has also been accused of not paying its bills, which could lead to more financial problems and allegations of being a broke queen, which should help the pipeline find common ground with young people, so maybe that's a blessing in disguise. Three, the pipeline would encroach on multiple sacred indigenous sites, several low-income and minority communities who are against the project, and some landowners even had to fight attempts by the pipeline to use eminent domain to seize their land. When pressed for comment, these groups echoed a shared sentiment: "You dag-nabbin pipeline and rapscallions better get off of my lawn!" Four, the pipeline's construction is already causing environmental damage. The pipeline's route crosses 1,146 streams, creeks, rivers, and wetlands, poses risk to several endangered species, and also goes through mountainous terrain that has a high risk for landslides, which could cause more damage and risk of explosions, the unfortunate consequences of insisting that the pipeline be built on the scenic route. So far, the pipeline owners have been fined over $2 million for over 300 incidents that hurt water quality. Imagine all the McDonald's Diet Cokes they could have bought with that money. 5. The pipeline has been sued several times for not following environmental laws, unlawfully obtaining permits, and crashing into Gwyneth Paltrow at a ski resort, and the Fourth Circuit Court has made several rulings against the pipeline as a result. Rather than, you know, just follow the law, the company building the pipeline has tried to move their cases to a different court and even petitioned for the Fourth Circuit to bring in different judges to hear their case. And 6, from a climate perspective, the pipeline would likely lead to somewhere around 6 to 16 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions, with some estimates going even higher. That's over 1,000 years of Taylor Swift using her private jet, and call it what you want. But long story short, we know all too well that even in our wildest dreams, the choice between Taylor Swift's jet and the Mountain Valley Pipeline is no delicate matter in this cruel summer of illicit affairs. This isn't karma or an enchanted dream. This is me trying to say I wish you would... No, we're dancing with our hands tied, and don't blame me if I choose Miss Americana over the Heartbreak Prince. It's nothing new to question death by a thousand cuts. Side note, one of our comedy writers asked me to share that Emma Falls in Love is about Kieran Culkin. All that said, the pipeline representatives and politicians from both parties have deemed the project as critical to the nation's energy security, energy reliability, and even argue that the project isn't adding new natural gas to the market as much as it's creating cheaper energy and transporting existing gas more safely. According to their website, the pipeline is about 94% complete, but one of the main final sticking points has been a 3.5-mile section of the pipeline that would travel through Jefferson National Forest and cross part of the Appalachian Trail, which would threaten endangered species, harm water quality, worsen erosion and sedimentation, and add an annoying stop to your family's summer road trip vacation. There have been several protests regarding this section of the project, and at one point, the head of Jefferson National Forest was reassigned for blocking food and water supplies to protesters. On second thought, maybe we should build a food and water pipeline. But the Fourth Circuit Court has continually struck down permits for this section of the pipeline due to violations of several federal environmental laws, including the National Environmental Policy Act, which we detailed in our permitting episode last month. Now, before I get into the latest Supreme Court ruling and what it means for the pipeline, I need to give a little legal history. It might seem completely irrelevant, but I promise we'll tie it back together by the end of the episode. I guess I should add I'm not a lawyer, which doesn't really help my case in any way, other than proving I did not say I was a lawyer, which I am in fact not, therefore proving I am a man of honesty. If Mike Ross can do it, so can I. And to kick things off, let's travel all the way back to 1787 to first check out the nastiest prototype of a toilet you've ever seen, but more importantly, to take a quick glance at the U.S. Constitution. Specifically, the branches of government and separation of powers. The United States has 3 branches of government, which wouldn't be a lot of branches for a tree, but it's chill for a government. There's the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. The legislative branch is Congress, composed of the Senate and the House of Representatives, and their primary responsibility is making laws. Basically, the mom of the house. The executive branch is led by the president, who can approve or veto laws made by Congress, but the president also appoints officials to head up various agencies who are in charge of enforcing the laws. Kind of like when your dad tells you to listen to your mother, and when he designates you to hold the flashlight when he works on the car. And the judicial branch is in charge of deciding the meaning of laws, how to apply them to real situations, and whether a law breaks the rules of the Constitution. Sort of like when your grandma comes over, says, you don't have to listen to her, grandma will take care of it, and then starts rearranging the whole kitchen. The judiciary is made up of many courts. There is the Supreme Court, which was established in the Constitution, and then Congress was given the authority to set up more courts. They've used that authority to set up 94 federal district courts, 13 circuit courts, and 7 basketball courts solely for settling in-house personal disputes. You know RBG had a filthy dunk. Separation of powers is the idea that each branch of government has to stick to its lane. We don't want one branch of government having undue power over the others. Rather, we want all the branches keeping each other in check. But going back to those different courts for a second, what Congress also has the constitutional power to do is assign jurisdiction to different cases. If a court has jurisdiction over a case, that means they have the power to hear it, decide it, dismiss it, bop it, twist it, pull it, or whatever else they choose to do. Jurisdiction is important. We don't want the Supreme Court to have jurisdiction over whether your aunt has to pay a parking ticket, since that's a waste of their time, and let's be honest, she's not going to pay it anyway. And we don't want Brown v. Board decided by Judge Judy. But since Congress makes the rules, they essentially get to assign jurisdiction however they see fit, with some notable exceptions. And that brings us to one of the early times they tried to exercise that power, the absolutely wild 1868 Supreme Court case of Ex parte McCardle. William H. McCardle was the editor of the Vicksburg Times in Mississippi during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. McCardle was an outspoken critic of the Union troops and Northern settlers that were occupying the South. His critiques in his newspaper irked the Union general heading the occupying forces, and in 1867, he had McCardle arrested, essentially for inciting rebellion. It's too bad he didn't have the foresight to start a podcast. I mean, he could say whatever he wants and nobody would notice. Watch this. Mufasa deserved it. And see, nothing's gonna happen to me. For the record, that was a joke. I would never actually think that. William McCardle challenged his arrest by applying for a writ of habeas corpus, which is not the Latin translation of Tim Burton's The Corpse Bride, but a type of legal recourse that demands a court review the legality of one's imprisonment. In this case, McCardle claimed his arrest violated his First Amendment right to freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and his case made it all the way to the Supreme Court. If he was right, which, let's be honest, it's pretty obvious that he was, it would have forced the Supreme Court to strike down the Reconstruction laws, an act that might have pissed people off to the point of starting another pre-Captain America Civil War. As such, it was likely the Supreme Court wanted nothing to do with this case. So the Supreme Court heard oral arguments and presumably had drafted an opinion that would strike down the Reconstruction laws, but before they got a chance to issue it, Chief Justice Samuel Chase was pulled away to preside over President Andrew Johnson's combo impeachment trial / 60th birthday blowout extravaganza. While that happened, Congress got together and passed a law that stripped the Supreme Court's authority to hear appeals on habeas corpus cases. President Johnson vetoed the bill, but Congress had a two-thirds majority, also known as the Uno reverse card of politics, and overrode the veto. With that, the focus of the case shifted to whether Congress had the right to strip the Supreme Court's jurisdiction over a pending case. And the Supreme Court, who may have gotten their wish on this, ruled in favor of Congress, affirming that Congress did indeed have the constitutional power to strip their own jurisdiction. As a result, McArdle's appeal was dismissed, and a few years later, Congress repealed that law and restored the Supreme Court's ability to hear habeas corpus appeals. Numerous legal experts have called it the governmental rendition of asking your long-term partner if you guys can go on a break for just a couple days before tearing up and saying they don't want to talk about it anymore. Now, the Supreme Court did set some limits on Congress interfering with them, actually within 2 years of the ex parte McArdle decision. To understand this case, we first need to mention the Captured and Abandoned Property Act of 1863. This law aimed to address the issue of returning or compensating for property seized, sold, or destroyed, or given an 1800s HGTV makeover by the Union Army during the Civil War. An important condition of this law was that the person claiming the property had to prove they hadn't supported the Confederacy during the war. In other words, they needed to show they'd stayed loyal to the Union. That brings us to the 1870 Supreme Court case of United States v. Paddleford. Edward Paddleford, a merchant from Savannah and a Confederate officer during the war, attempted to recover his share of cotton that was seized by the Union Army and later sold for a good profit. The federal government claimed Paddleford had supported the Confederacy because, duh. But post-war, Paddleford had taken a pledge of loyalty to the Union in exchange for a presidential pardon from President Lincoln. And I must say, imagine a Lincoln pardon. Like, that must be the Rolls Royce of presidential pardons. I'm not saying I want to be in a position to need a pardon, but if I did, I want it from Abraham goddamn Lincoln. I mean, the hat alone makes it worth it. But here's the thing. A pardon is, in effect, wiping the slate clean. In French terms, it's shaking the etch-a-sketch. A court can't hear evidence of a crime that a person has been pardoned for. And as such, the court agreed with Paddleford, stating that his loyalty pledge and his pardon cleared him of any offense against the Union, even if his property was seized before he took the oath. And as you can imagine, that same Congress that strong-armed the Supreme Court into giving them a hall pass for William McArdle was pretty pissed off about this, too. They believed that anyone needing to take a loyalty pledge clearly supported the Confederacy, pardon or not, kind of like how Colleen Ballinger's gossip train was quite sus. As such, they added a provision to a bill in 1870 that 1. Declared that taking the loyalty pledge proved a person's prior disloyalty rather than wiping the slate clean, and 2. Stripped the Supreme Court of its authority to rule on such cases, requiring them to be dismissed. What I wouldn't give to see the Kardashian-style confessionals from everybody involved in this beef. This brings us to the subsequent case of United States v. Klein, where the Supreme Court had to decide if 1. Only people named Calvin were allowed to wear Calvin Klein, and 2. They had to decide if this provision on the meaning of the loyalty pledge was constitutional, and somewhat unsurprisingly, they decided it was not. They felt this was more than just jurisdiction stripping. This was Congress trying to interpret the law and decide how a case should be resolved. As we said, Congress makes the laws, the court interprets the laws, and Hank Green gives us a crash course on all of it. Here, Congress wasn't setting a rule for the court to apply, they were interpreting the meaning of the loyalty pledge and presidential pardon. So how the hell does all of that relate to the Mountain Valley Pipeline? Well, it turns out that this is just the latest addition to the Questionable Congress Choices tasting tour. On June 3rd, President Biden signed the Fiscal Responsibility Act, or FRA, and Section 324E of the FRA contains two provisions relating to the Mountain Valley Pipeline and courtroom jurisdiction. First, Congress says no court shall have the jurisdiction to review any permit approval for the pipeline. And second, they say the D.C. Circuit Court has exclusive jurisdiction over any claim that this section of the FRA is invalid. Pretty cool of the FRA and the D.C. Circuit to have the exclusive talk. I mean, they had been in a situationship for so long, it was about time they admitted their feelings for each other. In all seriousness, what these FRA provisions mean is the Fourth Circuit, which is the court that oversees appeals in the West Virginia-Virginia region and has repeatedly struck down the Mountain Valley Pipeline, now no longer has jurisdiction over anything. They got relegated from the role of grandma to drunk uncle who still issues opinions, but now nobody listens to him. Of course, legal challenges were brought immediately to this portion of the FRA, saying Congress violated separation of powers here, and on July 10th, the Fourth Circuit issued a stay, which means that construction of the pipeline must stop while the court reviews those cases. They subsequently issued a sit, a paw, and a rollover. But then, on July 27th, the Supreme Court lifted those stays and said that due to the FRA, the Fourth Circuit did not have jurisdiction to do that. In other words, Congress not only stripped the Fourth Circuit of jurisdiction to hear cases about the pipeline, but they stripped them of jurisdiction to hear cases about whether they can hear cases about it. I wonder if anyone's tried bringing a case about whether they can hear cases 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 about the Mountain Valley Pipeline. Yeah, I think I just locked in my job at the NRDC. This sounds insane though, right? It's the most disturbing news I've heard since Ariana Grande announced she was getting divorced and started dating some guy who looks remarkably similar to her brother. Ari, love you girl, but maybe this should be more of a focusing on me era. If we forget the law, just you and me talking about it, it feels like a clear violation of the separation of powers. It feels like ex parte McCardle when Congress stripped the Supreme Court's authority mid-case and got away with breaking the First Amendment, however pure their intentions may have been. It feels like United States v. Klein, when Congress tried to retroactively decide a case that had already been decided. In fact, environmental groups are using Klein as precedent to call this section of the FRA unconstitutional. But here's the thing. The decision in Klein was not that Congress couldn't strip or change jurisdiction. They can make the rules. They just can't interpret them. They couldn't say a pardon was a sign of disloyalty, since that was an interpretation. But in this section of the FRA, all they did was 1. Strip jurisdiction, which unfortunately does not mean that they made jurisdiction sexier. By stripping jurisdiction, they said, sure, we made NEPA, we made the Endangered Species Act, and now we're changing the laws we made to say they don't apply to the Mountain Valley Pipeline. And 2. They moved jurisdiction. They said, we're in DC, Mountain Valley Pipeline is a project of national interest, and if you have a problem with us, you take it to the DC Circuit Court, not the Fourth Circuit. And in doing that, they changed the rules, but they did not interpret them. They didn't actually decide the case, they just changed the laws so that the case would go their way, which is basically stooping down to sibling rivalry rules. Congress, let the courts be player one on the Wii one time! Now I want you to stop and think for a second about what all that means. This is bigger than the pipeline. You can be for it or against it for all I care. What Congress did, what a bipartisan coalition in Congress did, was rather than tell the Mountain Valley Pipeline to follow the law, get their permits, and win their court cases, They said you can cobble together some permit approvals, and the court that you don't like can't say a word about it. Now, Congress does need the power to assign jurisdiction. After all, they are the ones that make the laws. We don't want the courts or the president or Ben Affleck doing that. But if Congress is going to use that power, that privilege, for something as underhanded and politically motivated as that, we all at the very least need to know about it and understand it. Every headline I see about this feels like a sports match. Mountain Valley Pipeline blocked. Mountain Valley Pipeline gets a win. Mountain Valley Pipeline gets whacked in the nards by a hockey puck. It pits the pro-pipeline people and the anti-pipeline people against each other. What it doesn't explain, and what we all need to take so seriously, is that a bipartisan coalition in Congress pulled out a tactic reminiscent of the one they used to skirt the First Amendment during Reconstruction to get this done. And barring a successful legal challenge in, I guess, the DC Circuit Court now, it seems to have worked. That's the bigger story to me. If I can give you two kernels of hope. One, a seal walked into a hardware store in New Zealand a couple weeks ago and it was really cute. And two, this is still a democracy. I have freedom of speech and freedom of press, and I can report this story to you. And you have the freedom to vote, speak your mind, tweet at whatever politician you want, and unless you're William McCardle, you will not be arrested for it. They still represent us. None of the thousands of lobbyists we talked about 3 weeks ago can change that. And they're banking on the fact that we won't take the time to understand what they did to push through the Mountain Valley Pipeline. Maybe they think we're too dumb. Maybe they thought it was for the greater good. Maybe they thought we'd be distracted by Barbenheimer. But regardless, there is plenty of recourse if they know their constituents didn't like this. They changed the rules, they can change them back. Sorry, Mountain Valley Pipeline, you can't be our golden boy. Get your permits like everybody else. Better yet, they can pass more permitting reforms so that every project can go through this process more quickly and receive more community input. Congress could consider streamlined permitting for specific project types, standardizing the process across states, improving transparency and community involvement, and more. But permitting woes aside, environmental protection matters. Clean air and water are critical, and no project should get a free pass. Regardless of our feelings on the pipeline, all Americans should be alarmed and appalled that Congress took their power of jurisdiction stripping, entrusted to them by we the people, and used it to ram through a political pet project. Just because Congress got player one doesn't mean they should spend the whole Super Mario Bros. Game picking up the judicial branch, throwing them off a cliff, and then refusing to pop the bubble that brings them back to life. And now, here's Emma with the news.
The entire southern United States weathered a vicious heat dome for the month of July. On July 18th, Arizona broke records when it officially hit 110 degrees Fahrenheit or higher for 19 consecutive days. I once experienced a similar situation when I accidentally left my oven on for an entire month. But this extreme heat, compounded by the fact that night temperatures have not dropped below 90 degrees Fahrenheit, resulted in heightened risks, particularly for the unhoused, incarcerated, and those without air conditioning. Some of the biggest groups the United States loves to neglect. But electricity demand has also reached record highs multiple times over the last week, and it's not because your little brother won't stop playing Call of Duty. Amidst rising heat levels and potential strike threats, the United Parcel Service, or UPS, and its drivers' union, represented by the epically named Teamsters, have reached a preliminary agreement addressing wages, forced overtime, and safety concerns due to lack of air conditioning in UPS delivery trucks. Yeah. UPS trucks do not have AC systems in them, which is why I would like to call them oops trucks, because they suck. But this deal, which averted what would have been a historically large strike, commits to installing air conditioning in all trucks by 2024, raising wages to a minimum of $21 per hour for part-timers and an average of $49 for full-timers, and discontinuing mandatory overtime on drivers' days off. Needless to say, the effects of Megan Thee Stallion's fourth hot girl summer in a row have been devastating. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA's, Disaster Relief Fund is expected to run out of money during peak hurricane and wildfire seasons, according to a recent warning from a top official. Apparently it all blew away and caught on fire. The number of costly natural disasters has significantly increased due to the climate crisis, hitting its rebelling teen phase, placing strain on FEMA. I would also like to report that this is putting a strain on me, because it makes me upset. So it would behoove everyone to knock it off. During a recent four-day visit to Beijing, the United States and China, the world's top two carbon polluters, failed to secure new climate agreements. Lame, but committed to ongoing discussions, according to U.S. climate envoy John Kerry. I did a similar thing with my situationship the other day when we failed to establish a dating agreement but agreed to ongoing discussions over Tinder DMs. Despite the lack of immediate breakthroughs, Kerry indicated that the dialogues were productive, with both sides recognizing the urgent need to address the climate crisis and agreeing to intensive future meetings. This directly parallels what I would say to my mom after getting grounded for hiding my Nintendo DS under my pillow, getting caught, and recognizing the urgent need for me to go to sleep. In a new study conducted for last month's Shark Week, scientists explored the potential effects of water pollution, specifically from drugs like cocaine, on shark behavior in Florida's waters. As the Florida coast serves as a significant point for drug trafficking, and no, I'm not talking about spring break, numerous packages of drugs end up in the sea, either lost or deliberately dumped by traffickers. This pollution then ends up in the shark's ecosystem, potentially causing abnormal behaviors such as erratic movement and uncharacteristic aggression. That's what happens when you give humans cocaine too, if you didn't know. The team plans to conduct further research by taking blood samples from the sharks to evaluate cocaine levels, with plans to place any irreversibly stimulant-dependent sharks into finance majors at the University of Miami.
Do you often have an urge to ruin the kickback by being a huge bummer? Then nihilism is for you. By describing yourself as a nihilist, you get a free pass to murder the vibe at any time by reminding everyone that they, their loved ones, and even the infinite expanse of the universe will all be cosmic dust someday. Best of all, you can use nihilism as an excuse for your constant doom-mongering yet lack of action on climate change. Sick. Nihilism, we get it. You think you're Rick from Rick and Morty.
The Sweaty Penguin is presented by Peril and Promise, a public media initiative from the WNET Group in New York, reporting on the issues and solutions around climate change. You can learn more at pbs.org/perilandpromise. Welcome back to Tip of the Iceberg. It's time for Ask Me Anything, where our listeners get a chance to ask me any environmental questions they may have. Submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so sign up today at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. We have a special treat for you today. We have a listener caller question. We have Heather on the line. Heather, how are you?
Hi, Ethan. I'm doing great. How are you?
I am good. So you have a question for us?
I do. I've been reading about the wildfires going on in Maui right now. And it's really worrisome, obviously, and so dangerous. And I've been thinking about the effect that it could potentially have on the wildlife. Because where do they go? You know, like, I'm wondering if you have anything to say about that. Like, how do we address what's happening with the wildlife right now?
Yeah, thanks so much for the question. And we're going to have a whole episode on the Maui fire next week. It kind of happened. I would have done it this week, but it happened like a day too late in our schedule. But yeah, well, we'll have a lot more next week, but that's a great question. I think
It remains to be seen to what degree the fire will impact wildlife. And I know that, understandably, we don't even have full death counts for human life quite yet. Actually, corals off the state shores in Hawaii are a big concern. The Aluwalu Reef, I was reading about, is one of the oldest reef structures in the Hawaiian Islands. And now that there's going to be runoff and debris with all this ash now raining into the ocean, that presents a big concern. It can block out sunlight that's important for photosynthesis. Experts have said that bees can be hurt. One of the big issues is that there are a lot of invasive plant species in Hawaii that were introduced by colonizers that we'll talk about more next week. Species like buffle grass and molasses grass. And these species are particularly drought resistant and fire resistant. So when a fire like this happens, as I understand it, these invasive species will make the fire worse, but then they'll beat out whatever native species are on the island and stick around. Similarly, there are conifer trees that were introduced by colonizers whose, I think it was a fire in 2018 in Maui where they found that the cones, like the pine cone equivalent of these conifers, were exploding and their seeds were they weren't just spreading the fire by exploding, but their seeds were spreading to other parts of the island. So the fires can certainly have drastic changes on the ecosystem beyond just the obvious loss of life.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'll be eager to hear more about it in the next episode that you do, for sure.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing it up this week for us. I think that we did an episode recently as well talking a bit about the Canada wildfires and how I fully understand how sad a story like this is. And I think that's important to get our heads around. At the same time, I wanted to reference then, and I hope we can continue to remember now, that there are solutions to wildfires. 85% of wildland fires in the U.S. are caused by human negligence. Things like unattended campfires, cigarette butts on the ground, that sort of stuff. And just not being stupid is a big step. And then from there, not doing things like introducing invasive grasses to new ecosystems and making sure we're managing our forests well, clearing out brush, all these different things that can be a big help even when climate change is making these events worse.
Yeah. I hope people really start to consider that more. Obviously, that's really quite bad.
Yeah, for sure. I hope it can offer some level of constructive path forward in a difficult time. Thanks so much for the question, Heather. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
And that does it for this week's episode of Tip of the Iceberg. Take 2 minutes, help out the show, and get a shout-out at the end of the show by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple or Podcast Addict, or join our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. There you get merch, bonus content, and your questions move to the front of the line for Tip of the Iceberg. And again, we've got twice the episodes now, so do send in your questions. And if you want to do a call-in, feel free to let me know as well. Always happy to do that. The Sweaty Penguin is presented by Peril and Promise, a public media initiative from the WNET Group in New York, reporting on the issues and solutions around climate change. You can learn more at pbs.org/Peril and Promise. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and guests. They do not necessarily reflect the opinions or views of the Peril and Promise or the WNET Group. Thank you all for listening, and I'll see you on Friday for a deep dive on the Denver-Julesburg Basin. This will be our 12th carbon bomb and a very interesting one in Colorado. So I will see you then.
Thank you.